listening to Sup Doc.
This is a show where we talk to interesting people, filmmakers, comedians that have strong opinions about their favorite docs. Hi, I'm Paco Romain.
And I'm George Chen.
And today we watch and talk about the documentary The Sheik.
This is a movie that's available on Netflix. It's a documentary about 80s wrestler The Iron Sheik. And we're going to be talking about it with San Francisco comedian Drew Harmon.
All right, so now we're into it. The Sheik. Sheik.
What's up, jabronis?
What's up, my jabroni? So we have Drew Harmon here talking about The Sheik, which is a documentary that you can watch and enjoy. We're talking about jabroni. Bring us back to the jabroni thing.
Jabroni, I had no idea that jabroni is the, I guess the etymology would be the word if we're going to use a fancy word about wrestling. Because we had The Rock for so many years that was jabroni, and he was one of the great trash talkers of wrestling of all time. And little did we know that The Rock was not the one who came up with that. It was the Iron Sheik. Although I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because the Iron Sheik is amazing on Twitter. He's amazing when he's done Howard Stern. Yeah. He's an amazing trash talker in general. So one of the great things about this documentary is learning that The Rock, one of the great trash talkers of all time, adapted that from the Iron Sheik.
Oh.
I never watched The Rock or watched much wrestling, so that was all new to me. But I've heard jabroni in the lexicon somewhere. It's clear what it is. It's like, it's a fuckboy, basically. Yeah. It's like the pre-fuckboy fuckboy, right? That's kind of what a jabroni is.
Oh, I didn't know The Rock was like a big trash talker.
He was very good at being the one who would, he was very flashy, get into people's heads, and if Joe Gorman did not enjoy Jack in the Box so much and would occasionally lift some weights and would get above 5 feet tall, The Rock is what Joe Gorman thinks he is in his head.
And Joe Gorman is a San Francisco comedian that makes up in stature with his mouth.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, that's what.
And the Rock was always very good. I mean, even at the recent WrestleMania, The Rock's whole thing is that he came out and talked trash. He wasn't wrestling.
Wait, did you go to the WrestleMania?
No. I saw it. Let's say a copy fell off a truck.
Sure.
That's how I saw it. But I know lots of people who did go.
Fell off a torrent truck?
Yes. Exactly. But The Rock's whole thing was he came out and he talked trash.
Okay.
And he creates tension. He brought out Ronda Rousey. And that was a whole thing. Ronda Rousey actually did the ass kicking in that whole segment. But The Rock was always really good at being a trash talker. And little did I know that he learned that one of his idols for trash talk was the Iron Sheik.
Ah, I get it.
Like, was The Rock a baby face, correct? Or was he a heel?
He kind of goes back and forth because people loved him because he was such a good... He was such a good persona, but I think he would kind of go back and forth between being a heel and a baby face.
And that's not me saying that he's a baby face. Like, I'm just like, Dwayne The Rock Johnson is so dreamy. It's like term I learned in the documentary.
Yeah, me too. Why don't you, Drew, tell us what that is, baby face and heel?
Well, baby face means good guy. It's the good guy in terms of for wrestling, like big time wrestling, for story and persona. A babyface is the guy that is the hero, the one that ultimately that you want to see win out. And the heel is the bad guy.
Right.
And it's like to have a really good storyline, anytime wrestling has really catapulted into the national consciousness, it's been because there's a really good heel. And the Iron Sheik was one of the best, especially when he came to big prominence because he's of Iranian descent. Even though he loved America, he didn't let that on. He would go out dressed like a sheik, Iranian flag, with the Iranian accent, and talk about how much he loved Iran and how terrible America was. And it was his ability to be the heel so well that in this documentary you find out that's how Hulk Hogan became Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, he needed the bad guy to be to react against.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting, I don't know if we're going sequentially through it, but he was the bodyguard to the Shah of Iran, which gets brought up. And it's funny because all the is kind of like phobia against Iran during in 79 when Carter was in office was against like the revolution that had happened. So it's like he was worried about getting knocked off.
He was
Shah. That was the thing that was interesting. So like he would have not done well if he stayed in Iran for either administration.
Right.
Yeah. Well, he was actually, he was a real wrestler. He wasn't like one of these guys who, you know, had been a football player and thought, I don't know how to do anything else. What can I do with my physicality to make some money? And I don't mind wearing spandex.
Yes.
It was the fact that he was an Olympic wrestler,
yeah,
and one of his heroes in Iran, an Iranian wrestler who had gone to the Olympics four times and been a big champion. He was actually, well, and the Iranian government said, as you learn in this documentary, that he committed suicide, but there was a lot of speculation that that was not the case. It was because he was gaining prominence as a popular figure, and he was not in agreement with the Iranian government.
His buddy.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is Takhti.
Yeah,
I think
Takhti,
his name.
That's
Takhti,
right.
Yeah.
I was trying to look that up, yeah.
And he, I'm making air quotes, committed suicide.
Yeah.
Right.
Because people were afraid that he could actually be the king of Iran because he was so popular.
Yeah,
and
people
he
loved
was,
him.
Yeah, people loved him. And so in the documentary, I believe the Shah says, what do you want, money? Do you want a house? And he said, no, why don't you make some highways?
Takhti, yeah, said this.
And
yeah.
Some schools and, you know, make our country better. And they're like, oh, man, you got to go.
Yeah, yeah. That's not going to work. If you're not in it for personal glory,
yeah,
then we've got to
get
rid
of you. Get the fuck out of here. I liked earlier, George, when we were talking, you had a funny parallel between...
Oh, yeah. Like, because like it's like having this guy who ended up being this huge wrestling figure as your Secret Service. Sort of like, what if like Ric Flair had been like LBJ's, like, you know?
Or Reagan's.
Or Reagan. Like, yeah, like he took the bullet from...
Ted Bundy, God, or not Ted Bundy? No. That's way off.
John.
No, it's Hinckley.
Hinckley.
Yeah,
yeah,
John,
yeah.
Hinckley.
Jody Foster's Army is the reference I was thinking.
But just picturing Ric Flair and Speedo like standing next to Reagan, like, you know, like, it's so American. It's a weird that it hasn't happened.
Well, my co-host on my podcast, he went to WrestleMania, but he also attended an event where there was a lot of old wrestlers there to sign autographs and stuff, and Ric Flair was there. And so he walked up and he said that Ric Flair, no one has told Ric Flair that it is not 1988 ever.
Nice.
That Ric Flair is still pretty sure that it's 1988, that he's supposed to be partying, that he's supposed to be getting 25-year-old girls, and that no one's told him that he is as red as a tomato and his, his hair is just shock white.
Yeah.
And he said he looks terrified.
And what is he, in his 60s probably?
Yeah, I think it's early 60s. And he's lived pretty hard, but it would be hilarious to see him standing next to Ronald Reagan in pictures.
Yeah. I was thinking about how, like, I didn't know how hard partying those guys were. I mean, their bodies, I guess, could take all kinds of internal and external damage.
Well, it was the 80s. As they say, as one of the people say in the documentary, decadence wasn't just limited to, say, Wall Street or rock music at the time. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you've got these wrestlers who are touring around, making a bunch of money, and they're working really hard. And at some point, and it's at that age, especially in the 80s, wrestling was notorious for people would, like, Andre the Giant was notorious for drinking cases and cases of beer on the road. In fact, there's stories of other wrestlers as they were coming up, their job would be, not only would they have to get there and wrestle, they would have to drive Andre the Giant in the van, because if Andre the Giant he can't drive his own car. And when he would go places, he would just want to drink beer the whole way. So they would sit him in the back seat. They would take one of the chairs out of the van, and he would just sit there drinking beer. But he couldn't get out and go into a liquor store or a party store, in the parlance of our Michigan brethren. And he couldn't get out because he would get mobbed. So he just send this nobody wrestler in, and like, here's another case of beer, and then and Andre's good to go. And he would just drink cases and cases of beer, and that
the
was
internship.
Kind of,
yeah.
you're on Andre doing.
Speaking of
that's a posse
of Michigan. Michigan, Drew and I both grew up in Michigan. I was telling George this earlier. One of my wrestle stories is that when I was in middle school, I told my parents a lie, and I told them that I was asked to be in the Young Lawyers Association, and in order to be in that group that I made up, I had to go to Lansing, because that's where the group met, and I went to see WrestleMania in Lansing, Michigan, and I spit on the Iron Sheik. He walked by my friends and I spit on him, which was, I thought, incredible. But Dr. Wu was there. Snuka, Superfly Snuka, Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan. It was incredible. I had so much fun.
That must have been. And they were at, I forget that WrestleMania was in Lansing, and then they a big one was at the Pontiac Silverdome.
Right. Later was one at the Pontiac that I did not go to. But
I feel like in the last like 15, 20 years, all I hear is there's like this, the Lucha Libre, like the Mexican mask wrestling happening. And so it's just like, check it out. It's going to be like half burlesque, half like this Mexican mask wrestling style. So I've never gone to any of those things. But that's what I think of, like what like the level of wrestling in my closest circle, which is not really my circle at all. I don't really know. I'm not never been a big wrestling guy.
So well, and it's funny is I don't consider myself a big wrestling guy. I was familiar with it. I would watch it when I was a kid, and I've stayed moderately. Like I could watch WrestleMania and kind of know the storylines. One thing I'm surprised by is how many people in our social strata of comedians love wrestling. That there were a lot of people who did go to WrestleMania when it was at when it was down in San Jose or Santa Clara
just recently.
Yeah,
right.
And it's funny that they're so into it. And then I think about it, and it makes sense because there's a predetermined storyline, but it all comes down to how well you can perform it. Which for comics is that you're coming in with material, but you want to make it look natural and easy. The only difference is that physically you're typically in very good shape, and it looks like you're capable of accomplishing things physically, which most of us are not.
Well, when this documentary gets, I'm skipping around, but when it gets into that place where he's talking about like the independent wrestling scene, I'm like, oh, that is like pretty much like what we're doing all the time. It's like a high school gym, you know, and a bunch of people like there's not even like a crowd cheering. They're just like watching these men beat each other with chairs.
Right. Yeah.
Well, so like for people who, I mean, I would imagine most people will watch the documentary and then listen to this, hopefully, because there's won't be any spoilers. But one thing that happens to the Iron Sheik is he falls from grace in the documentary. And then you see him going on the independent circuit. We had an older Iron Sheik. And, you know, less nimble. But it is kind of sad because he is in high school gymnasiums and stuff. And there's like, he says, 90,000 people to 90 people.
Yeah.
You know?
It's real sad to watch that drop because the other part of that is that he was a part of the big of wrestling when it became a big thing. Like Vince McMahon, when Vince McMahon took it into the arenas, made it a nationally or international touring thing, he was there and he was part of the big movement that got Hulk Hogan to where he was to be this huge event. And then because of his dumb mistakes with substances and cocaine and just hanging out with Jake the Snake and all of that stuff.
May I interject for a second? I so badly want a Jake the Snake reality show.
Oh, God,
just from the 3 minutes he's on screen in that documentary, I was like, I want to know more about Jake the Snake.
I feel like Jake the Snake in this documentary looks like they woke him up from the cell of a holding tank and said, you're going to be in this documentary.
The way they shot it, too. Yeah.
He couldn't possibly have looked worse. Like he did, his hair is a mess, and he literally looks like he just drank a Mountain Dew and put his cigarette out, and they just were like, action, you know, like
he looks like your hungover uncle.
Yes,
one of those guys is also a comic now, like
Mick Foley.
Mick Foley.
He's doing stand-up.
Mankind. Yeah, he was just at Cobb's not that long ago. My co-host also went to see him. My co-host was a big wrestling.
And what's the name of your podcast?
Chucklepedia.
Chucklepedia.
Yeah. But he went to see Mick Foley. And Mick Foley was on WTF recently, too. And he admits, he says, I'm not a stand-up, but he's been doing these one-man shows. And he brings a comic to open for him to kind of warm it up. But he says he's got his material and his well-trod stuff. Mm-hmm. But he's also, he kind of got out when he knew he should get out, and he never seemed to be much of a drug or booze guy.
Right.
Yeah.
He destroyed his body too, Mick Foley, right? I mean,
There's a documentary about him as well, and there's also an interesting one about people who dress up like Santa Claus, and I did not know until I saw that Mick Foley is a Christmas fanatic, and he keeps a room in his house specifically for a Christmas tree and Christmas decorations. And where I was talking about guys who would have to drive Andre the Giant around, people didn't like to ride with Mick Foley because if you rode in Mick Foley's car, you had to listen to Christmas music no matter what time of year it was.
Man.
But he managed to kind of avoid some of the pitfalls. Yeah.
That sounds like an Errol Morris documentary about people that have Christmas all. Maybe it is. Maybe he made one.
It's an interesting story because Mick Foley, of course, is the good level of that, because there's also guys in that documentary. We're talking about a whole other documentary, but it's worth seeing just because there's guys who they live the Christmas lifestyle all year round, and much
guys that are like full beard Santas year round. Yeah,
so
I've
heard about this. Was Foley a heel or a baby face? He wasn't either, right?
He went back and forth as well. That is, you know, even Hulk Hogan at one point. Several points would play the heel.
I'm old enough to remember when Hulk Hogan was bad.
Yeah.
Pre-Hulkamania.
Yeah.
Like, he wore silver.
Yeah, that's
And what
right.
was his state? It wasn't even Hulk then. It was something else.
I forget. I can't recall. That was a little bit before my time. Was when I came into being aware, Hulkamania was in full swing. Yeah. So it was,
That reminds me of one other thing, which is just, like, how fucking racist it was.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's so fucking racist. But it's made by another family friend, technically. The directors of this documentary are actually twin brothers, which is like why I was confused when they were on screen. Sometimes
it'd
be like one or the other. I'm like, wait, was that who is this? So it's not me being racist. It's just they are twin brothers.
Yeah.
And then they didn't really address that so much. It's like he was, very he adopted the American lifestyle, married this Midwest woman.
Yeah, in Minnesota.
Kids.
How? Yeah. I mean, it's so incredible. Because I'm like, who is this woman? And then she's like, well, when I first saw him and his body of golden lusciousness. And I was like, but she's from Minnesota. So she's like, oh, my God, it's the Iron Sheik, you know? Like, oh, he's so hot, you know? And I was like, what is going on? It's so amazing that he married her, and then they're still together. This nice
Are
Midwestern.
Are they together? Is that how that ended? I was confused.
Yeah.
Did he move back in the house fully?
I think they clearly went through some rough times.
Clearly,
but it seems like when he was really deep into his addiction, she still stood by him, although she was none too happy that he was. Smoking crack at that point, which is always when he says something about I want to go get my medicine, and then you find out it's crack, like that's pretty twisted.
And he's like soft medicine, green medicine, hard medicine. It's you'd have a lot of medicine.
His leg is fucked up the whole movie, pretty much. Like I could understand he's in like chronic pain, I'm sure.
Yeah,
but I don't think crack is like the way to heal your broken leg.
Not that I found.
It's a different kind of cane, you know.
That's good. So let's go back to the beginning then. And so they show him in Iran. Mm-hmm. They show him looking like just a stud, man. The guy looks like a physical specimen. He's in like incredible shape, and then he starts wrestling, and does he win a gold medal with Iran?
He gets a for training the team. I think he got a gold medal for the training.
Oh, right.
That's what happened. And then like later he gets the belt, which seems almost surprising. Are those predetermined? Like, did he get that in a predetermined way?
They mention in the documentary that when the Iron Sheik was becoming prominent, but they were Vince McMahon and the whole organization knew that they were going to go towards Hogan. They wanted Hogan to be the champion,
but they
knew they needed a middle. So I think it was Burt Backlund, something like that. That he had actually been a wrestler. He was a very basics wrestler. He would just wrestle in blue trunks, and he didn't have like a big gimmick like the '80s became notorious for. And he also didn't respect Hulk Hogan. That he didn't want to lose the belt to Hulk Hogan. So then the storyline that they came up with was the Iron Sheik comes in, he says terrible things about America, he beats our champion, he holds onto the belt for a little while, and then Hogan comes in and Hogan is going to drop the leg and be the one who takes the belt from the Iron Sheik and proves America's great. Guitar solo, jets fly over, all that fun stuff.
Right. I gotta say, I was really good at the figure four leg drop. I could impose some pain on brothers and sisters, and the camel clutch. Like those were my two moves. Did you have a wrestling move that
I would do? I actually went for the figure four as well.
Nice.
I'm guessing these all occurred on trampolines.
Yeah.
Like those were the wrestling mats.
You're right. Now, if
suburban
people who are listening to this, you can't see this, but he's actually doing it on George right now. The figure four
suplex. Fuck you in the ass.
We had foam mats that my dad would get from these weird factories in Michigan that would end up giving us rashes a lot of the times. And then because it's Michigan, we would shovel off a ring And that, so you could jump off snow piles and stuff. You could, from the top turnbuckle, you know.
It's every family in Michigan has, like, these things where someone they know works in a factory and they had something that they can't sell, that they realize it's dangerous.
Yes.
And so then they just start giving it out.
To play in the quarry.
Yeah. You just have to agree not to sue them. My parents' counters for years were this type of formica that some local manufacturer had made, realized it wasn't as sturdy as it had to be, that they were going to end up getting sued if they would sell it to people. So then lots of people started, like, well, they would just give it to you, so you start using it in your counter, and then eventually it cracks if you set a hot something pot on it or something, and you're like, well, I got it for free, so
I can't complain.
Fuck me, I guess.
Can't complain against that.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So the Sheik, because his buddy commits suicide, once again, air quotes, he doesn't flee, but he comes to America because he loves America and land of opportunity.
They don't go into it too much, but he decided the best place for him to be was America. And he stopped in New York for a couple of weeks, but then found his way to Minnesota, which is where I guess the Olympic team at the time was training. And the funny thing is that he really embraced the American dream like no other. That it becomes funny that he's such a heel, and that his whole shtick is I hate America, death to America.
Yeah.
Because he very much the one story ranch house in Minnesota, shoveling snow, white wife and three daughters and all that. And
that is my American dream too. get a white wife. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Yeah, but I did think, like, his compatriot in that was
Nikolai Volkov,
So it was, like, in the 80s, just, like, total fear of Iran, fear of the other, fear of this Cold War going on. And they're, like, the two obvious heels in all these fights.
Yeah.
Which I remember that time period being very weirdly racist in general, and it's weird because the guys making the documentary are like, oh, it was great to see the Sheik on screen. I'm like, he's being the bad guy. It's sort of like that scene in Back to the Future where there's just, oh, you know, they're just brown people with rockets.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. You know, like that's such a given. Robert Zemeckis isn't a racist. It's just, you know, we just want to go back to 1950.
Yeah.
That's all. We just want to go back to the 50s.
Yes.
So it's a weird angle on that. I think it's interesting because the directors are also Persian or Iranian. I don't know if you're allowed to say Persian. I don't know what the difference is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Farsi, they speak Farsi. It's mm-hmm. culturally, it is Iranian. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, that was also the era when it was pre-wrestling admittedly being a show, that they were still trying to play up that it was real, that these storylines were real, that these wrestlers were doing real things. But I don't think at this point everyone understands it's fake, but clearly there's a lot of damage being done too, because these guys are taking a lot of damage, and so now but back then that the reality of it seemed to be part of the attraction, or at least as far as as Vince McMahon and the everyone in the company thought, people have to think it's real. So he played it up for sure, and that's of course one of the things that leads to his downfall is when he gets caught partying with the guy that he's supposed to be a rival with, then they kick him out of the league.
It's not so much the drugs as, like, the what? They're friends?
Was it
like, that's the part. That's
Dugan? wasn't that the guy?
Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Yeah, Duggan, yeah. I think that's incredible that the New York Times was like, is it fake? Question mark. Like, there was a time when we didn't know in America if big time wrestling was fake or not. Yeah. I love that. I mean, you could say the 50s had innocence to it, but this is the 80s. I mean, there's so much innocence in the 80s as well. Like, where people just weren't sure if big time wrestling was fake. I think, I gotta say, is Vince McMahon just a genius or what? Like,
he's a very shrewd businessman. Still to this day, I don't, when he didn't make an appearance at WrestleMania that I saw, his daughter now seems to be the public face, because I can only imagine what he physically, because clearly,
it's
I mean,
Al Davis-ized or something.
Yeah. He, but very shrewd, very smart. And, but also when it came down to business, he could be very cruel, that the Iron Sheik had helped them get to a certain stratosphere. But once he became a detriment to the company, then he was out. And that's where the Sheik's life takes a very steady
and
downturn.
Doesn't Vince McMahon like publicly say they will no longer wrestle for WrestleMania? And like the Iron Sheik and Hacksaw were out.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were banished.
It was, yeah, that was a big, and it clearly took a big hit to both of their lives. If Hacksaw, I don't know what he's doing now. I don't think he appeared in the...
Well, there was like definitely there's a career downturn, but there is also like this personal tragedy that I guess at some point we have to address.
Yeah.
Which I definitely contributed to his mental health, because I could see him like having some success on the indie circuit by being like a guy, you know, it's like going back to the minor leagues, I guess.
Yeah.
But he was working, he was getting something, some work, but he seemed to have a full on breakdown, and they didn't really make it clear if he was doing drugs the whole time or if the drug stuff kind of came back in hard as a way of coping with what ends up being like, it's, you know, spoiler, the murder of his daughter in like 2003, I think is when that happened.
Well, and I think the cocaine was already a very prominent thing when he got booted out. And I think cocaine was just prominent everywhere. If you had some extra spending money, you were in a performance field, you're expected to be on all the time. They just, you know, cocaine is just works for that. I've done radio. When I worked in radio,
I thought you were gonna say something else.
Yeah, well,
I've done.
Well, no, I've worked in radio, and there are guys who were around in the 80s. In the 80s, for radio, was a very decadent time, and there are all these guys who were getting six-figure salaries to host morning shows in regional areas, and bands will come into town. And they get to go party with the band. So you've got like Motley Crue coming in. You're some guy on like Buddy and the Weasel on KPO.
Dr. Crazy and the Bulldog.
KPOO in Minnesota. And suddenly the Motley Crue comes in, and they come in the show and like, you guys got to come hang out with us tonight.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're doing, you're blasting rails next to Motley Crue. And then you go in and you do your morning show and you're still making six figures. And so these guys, either they die off, or when I was still working in radio, they would still be there, but radio had been gutted. It's like everything had been gutted, but these guys, you could still tell, like, they just wish there was a mound of cocaine on the mixing console, and they had some other guy sitting next to there, and they can do the
sound effects.
We're gonna do the fat girl bikini contest, and no one seems to mind that we're terribly racist. We're drunk all the time, and we're making a ton of money. And that time was just so decadent. So I think the drugs were playing a very big role. And then he starts having all these problems, and then it becomes a way of escaping. So in one, it began as, like, I think for a lot of addicts, it probably does, that I'm celebrating, that my life is going amazing, so I want to make it better. And then when they're really down, they're like, well, my life sucks, but you know, it'll make it better.
Yeah. Well, they do a really good job. The filmmakers do a good job of foreshadowing that by saying, they show some wrestlers saying, oh, when he partied, he was fun.
Yeah.
Sure, he drank a lot, but it was never a mean drunk. He was a fun drunk.
Yeah.
And then they kind of foreshadow what's about to happen to him, which is the arrow starts to fall a bit. And it's very touching. I teared up when I saw him trying to talk about his daughter who was murdered, and he even asked the filmmakers, do I have to talk about this? Like, you can tell it's really, really. He has three beautiful daughters, one of them which was unfortunately murdered by her boyfriend, and then he just goes and spirals down, right? He starts doing cocaine and then crack and all that kind of stuff. And
I think in his position, he'd always been very strong and able to, he'd been in control of stuff. And then he lost control of his career. And then he didn't have any control over what happened to his daughter. And so therefore, you see the reasons for a spiral. And so the only thing he can control is, I'm going to smoke a ton of crack.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a very sad way to go down.
And what an odd, like I think you were mentioning earlier, what an odd drug for an actual athlete, someone at the someone who's been in control for so long.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak too much. I have been sober for a while, and part of that means attending a secret club that I can't talk about too much. But I will
it's
say,
a fight club.
Yeah, it's a fight club. We're not allowed to talk about it. It's the first two rules. But yeah. In those discussions, you can find a lot of people who, no matter what walk of life, for some reason, crack attracts people who are really looking to hit a wall.
Right.
That seems to be the one where it'll take you to the highest possible level of highness, but it's guaranteed that crack never ends well. There's never been a good story. Like George Clinton may claim that he smoked crack for decades and decades and somehow kept it together, although I don't know of any good Parliament Funkadelic tracks that were recorded in the last 20 years, but
with PCU, is that PCU?
Yeah, that was his only his biggest contribution to society during that 20 years. So crack for some reason just seems to be the biggest escape, that if I'm looking for the trap door,
it's cheap.
Crack.
And it's actually cheap. The cheap thing, and that's part of like why it took over is how cheap it was
and gets you fucked up.
Yeah,
I thought it was kind of funny and ironic that he goes to confront Ford in Toronto, the mayor, about smoking crack and being a loser and not doing the good things for good people of Toronto.
Well, because then it's the funny thing that I found about the Sheik is that his story is very touching, but it's not because the Sheik is willing to talk about it. Like, clearly he still comes from a very manly man type of place. He doesn't want to talk about his daughter. And then when you start to get to the depths of his addiction, he doesn't like to talk about that either. He clearly, the movie kind of just, it's like a smash cut to he's using and he's having a serious problem to suddenly he quit doing drugs a while ago and he doesn't do them anymore.
Right.
And it's just smash cut to now the Sheik's sober.
And he's got beautiful little granddaughters. And I know it's, they don't delve too much. I think George was actually mentioning earlier too, when we were talking about this documentary, that he was like hoping that it was even more warts and all kind of thing. Yeah. Like there's some warts.
The fact that those guys that made it are like, they're like his managers now.
Yeah.
And they're like running his Twitter account for them. It's going to be like soft peddling in a way, even though they do show like the bottom. It's still somehow, to me, I feel like there's a lot of like stuff where it's like, well, they did a Kickstarter to do this movie.
Yeah.
They raised like 40 grand, or they did an Indiegogo to do this movie. And so while I liked a lot of things about the movie, I feel like there's something that feels a little disingenuous about it because of like they're like family friends with this guy. It is like pumping him up in this way where 75% of the movie is every wrestler saying how great he is.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, he does seem like a really interesting guy with a really interesting story, but I felt like they kind of soft pedaled it a little bit.
I would agree with that too, and I do wish the documentary had hit a little harder. And I actually think they would have found that the more honesty they have with the Sheik and about his story,
that would humanize
in general,
him more.
That would humanize him more and make people even more attached to him. Because part of the problem with the Iron Sheik is that it's the flash of this guy being a huge trash talker. He's hilarious on Twitter. He says these terribly offensive things. But deep down, you know that he's this human being who's doing this he's playing a role.
And it's so goddamn uniquely American. The whole thing, the fact that he's not even American is so a uniquely American story, to it. I mean, he sees... It's all about opportunity and being I do agree that the impartiality of the people who made the film are also his managers. So if the film does well, they do well, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Paige and Gian Magan, those are the Canadian twins, the Iranian-Canadian twins that directed the movie.
And their dad was his friend?
Yeah, he was like champion of, was it ping pong?
Oh, that's right, table tennis. That's right, table tennis.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I do love a good game of table tennis. So what attracted you to this documentary?
It was relatively new, as I do enjoy a good documentary. And then the Iron Sheik, I find nothing more fascinating than these stories of like old wrestlers. We were talking about this before, is that to see these guys, because it is, they're aware that it's such a short lifespan and the chances for glory are so slim, but they still, and they know physically that it, you know, the best case scenario is they make it out after a couple, like The Rock is the best case scenario.
Yeah,
like even
that's true. That really is.
Yeah. Even Hulk Hogan, who was arguably the biggest star other than The Rock. And he may have, even at, in his peak, he was everywhere.
A governor?
No.
No, that's a Ventura, oh, Jesse Ventura. Body. The body.
Yeah. That's how little I know.
Well, and Jesse Ventura is also completely insane.
Yeah.
But Hulk has been, he's like, Hulk still has to show up. Hulk still has to do all these events.
Yeah.
The Rock
stay in shape.
Yeah. He's still got to stay in shape. He's been decimated by a divorce. He's still got to, you know, wobble his way out to as many events as possible to try to make his
nut. Brother.
And whereas The Rock is the smartest one of all of them, who's made it work. Yeah. It's such a case of diminishing returns for so many of these guys.
It's almost like the porn world, if you think about it. Like, yeah, going straight is like the goal, the golden ring, right?
Yeah.
So like, how many porn people are like, oh, I'm gonna get out of porn. It pays me really well. My body is up for a limited amount of time, but like, maybe I can get legit acting work at some point. It's almost like a parallel thing.
And like Tracy Lords is the best case scenario on that. Like she,
or
like
Sasha Gray or someone.
Yeah, Sasha Gray. Like, so an episode of Entourage or a Kevin Smith movie.
Right. Ugh, like, if that's getting out, being on in a Kevin Smith movie.
But so it attracts me because I love to see these old wrestlers. I like to see the story, like in the old glory days of, like, it was such a crazy time, big personas, big, you know, just big people in general, that it's fun to see where what happened.
I mean, we're all kind of the same generation, so I feel a little weird that I kind of missed out on this. Maybe it was more of a Midwest thing. Maybe it's the fact that, like, I did, like, Taekwondo when I was a kid, that was maybe my outlet for that. And I was aware of all this stuff, but I think it was more, like, cartoons.
Right.
And, like, somehow, like, I didn't get as into... I never, like... I mean, I think I had to take wrestling in junior high, but I never, like... for fun would wrestle people, but I would kind of pretend, like, you know, attack them with my Taekwondo skills.
Well, there was, like, in Michigan, Detroit had a local wrestling scene. I remember watching local wrestling from a Detroit WKBD, I think it was, that used to show, like, local...
the UHF station or
something. Yeah, yeah, like local Detroit wrestlers. Yeah. And it was, like, black and white, as I recall, and, like, kind of weird and grainy.
And I would, when I first got to college and was going into broadcasting, there were jobs that I never did it, but some of my cohorts would take these jobs where they would go and shoot local wrestling, that it would happen a couple times a year, that they would go and set up old, they had old cameras, like they would get the cameras once the TV station was done with them, set it up, and then they would hire students to operate the cameras. And it was people who were regional, like they were an accountant, or they were, you know, they were a gym teacher or something like that.
Yeah.
And they just were trying to get a little bit of that glory of the crowd. And that's right. And, you know, speaking as comedians, we all know that you end up kind of chase it once you've got a taste of that.
Yeah, you chase that dragon.
Yeah, you chase that dragon of the, and we all know way too many people who have gotten a big laugh or had a big set once, and years later they're still chasing the dragon.
Yeah,
with that same set.
There's so much parallel to, like, the music scene or, like, the comedy scene.
Yeah.
Well, the cocaine thing in the comedy scene specifically is very similar. Or just, like, the idea of being this kind of weird road dog, like, down the, like, years later. The guy's 70. He still has to kind of be, like, a road dog.
I know.
But they found a good out for him, which was...
Yeah.
It's, like, almost like the George Takei thing. It's, like, he got big on social media.
Yeah.
And that has been his saving grace of, like, not having to physically put himself out there, because he can't.
Yeah.
He's, like, got a busted leg. They were wheeling him around in a wheelchair a lot of the time. They didn't even really get into that stuff. Part of the Indiegogo money was also just to get him leg surgery.
Oh.
They raised like $40,000. Part of that was like the documentary, part of it was the leg surgery.
That's not surprising, because he definitely was hobbled up. At one point, he's walking on the side of his foot.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Ugh.
It was
that
a mess.
That looked bad. I agree. So one thing that I liked, I mean, obviously The Rock, I mean, he's America's sweetheart at this point, but I didn't realize his dad was in a wrestler. I don't know anything about Dwayne Johnson. Like, I didn't know that he had come from a wrestling family.
Yeah, that's something that I had known somehow before, that his dad was a wrestler. And so Dwayne Johnson kind of grew up around it. Yeah, second generation. It's amazing that there's in that business that someone, but it's, you can see, and I think in America, you see a lot of people where, especially in entertainment fields or something like that, where someone grows up watching their father or their mom doing something specific, doing stand-up or being an actor or something like that. And they start to see like, oh, well, it's possible because they've seen it done. The Rock also had the advantage of seeing how his dad did it and then taking it to the next level. So then now he can be in 900 Fast and Furious movies. And it's funny that he embraced the American dream so much, but then his embracing of that meant like, well, this is the character I'm going
to
play.
Yeah. Like to like kind of sell out your own race in a certain way. That's what I thought was weird about, not that it was a sellout of, but like, it does have a little bit of that implication of like, like I'm going to like Uncle Tom it up to a certain degree.
Well, when it comes to the 80s, there was so much kind of inherent racism, but I did find it funny that the filmmakers talked about how they were happy just to see him on the screen.
And
my wife is Filipino, grew up in Michigan, and she has a fondness for stuff like 16 Candles. And you've got like
Long Duk Dong. Oh, let's talk about it.
Well, and I had not seen that movie until I was already approaching 30 years old.
Really?
That I just, for some reason, I just skipped over it.
Yeah.
And my wife was very fond of it. So then one day we sit down and watch it. And I was amazed at the racism and that also that she wasn't offended by it. And she told me, well, it's because there weren't many representations of Asian people for me to see in movies. So when I see an Asian person, I just find it funny that he's such a dominant character, that he is so prominent. He gets a lot of screen time, and he's affecting the whole story. Like he gets a big white girl that he's kind of cracking fun at the old white people. That is what she took from it, not that he's a very racist portrayal.
I guess that is a reading I have not really thought about. Like he gets what Joan Cusack at the end.
Yeah.
So I guess even though he's basically portrayed as this, now we're turning into a 16 Candles podcast. Molly Ringwald was just here, right? She did her jazz standards or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I always view that character as a very emasculating Asian male stereotype. But he does kind of get the white lady who's a giantess and is also kind of like an equal dork. But yeah, I definitely have a different feeling about that movie than a lot of people would. But that kind of brought me back to a thought that I was having about wrestling, which is seems like a way of like kind of like learning about masculinity or having these role models for masculinity.
Yeah.
You know, which maybe is why I didn't relate to it. I had Long Duk Dong. You guys had like Hulk Hogan. So
Dr. Wu.
I mean, Bruce Lee was probably the closest thing for us. And I could see like maybe for those guys because Iron Sheik was such like a badass, even if he was like playing into these racial.
Well, he won the belt. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was the champion. He beat everybody else, which is one way
to
take it.
But how staged were those things? Like, how staged was that?
Very.
Staged. So, I was going to say, as a side note, do you guys know Bob Mould?
Yeah.
From Husker Du? Yeah. Lives in San Francisco now. He had this stint, I think, in the 90s where he wrote for the wrestling. And, like, the idea of writing for wrestling is kind of like writing for a soap opera, right? You're not necessarily, like, writing the dialogue. You're like building the arcs of what's going to happen during the season. So he has this sort of weird background.
That's interesting.
It's very interesting. Like this guy, a gay dude from a punk rock band, ended up being a huge
person. Isn't Husker Du from Minnesota?
Yeah, they started in Minneapolis. Yeah, the Minneapolis band.
The guy who wrote Zen Arcade also wrote for wrestling. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting side note. And he's a local guy. Maybe he'll hear this and we could bring him in.
If you hear this, Bob, give us a ring at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Cool. I did want to touch on, we're talking about the way he came back into prominence. Howard Stern, because I don't think in this day and age Howard Stern gets enough credit for still being so prominent. But I have been a listener of Howard Stern for a very long time. And sometimes I go out and I won't listen for a few months, but I'll come back in eventually. I always end up coming back to it. And Stern would have the Iron Sheik on. And because he's such a dominant person, personality. And it really, what Stern likes to do is give people an opportunity to be the big personality. So he just kind of opens the door. And that's where one of the reasons the Sheik had an opportunity to shine is that he's this big personality. Yeah. He's crazy. He doesn't mind being such a big outsized personality. And because he's so funny on that show, then other people will tune in at Stern. And 90% of the time when you hear something about so-and-so was on a radio show and said this, it's always on the Howard Stern show. Yeah. And for some reason now I think people...
Right.
They're trying to discount that it was Stern because he's on Sirius XM or because it's Stern or because...
Right, right.
Now that he's on Sirius, do they just have 24 hours of Stern on that station? Is it just like backlogs?
He's got two channels. So his schedule, he only does like three shows a week typically. And he does get to go on a lot of vacation time because his contract's pretty lenient. But they have all the old tapes. Mm-hmm. So they will play old shows constantly. And then he does programming where he'll have crazy people who he'll give a weekly show, and it's just a chance to hear 2 hours of a completely insane person.
Okay.
And it's amusing.
He's kind of been like a kingmaker in that weird way of like breaking these cult celebrities.
Yeah.
But like, I know like someone like Greg Fitzsimmons is like a huge part of that show.
Yeah.
Like, that's where he gets a lot of his fan base.
Yeah.
From.
And George Takei as well. Yeah. George Takei was one of the first places where he really came out in the public persona. Stern, when he first kind of came out as a gay man, Stern had him on and was asking him questions about his life as a gay man throughout the years, including way back in the Star Trek era.
Oh, yeah.
And it is fascinating radio, and Takei was so forthcoming and funny that it really helped kind of rocket George Takei back up as well into prominence and into the public awareness. So the Sheik the same way. So I'm just saying as a Howard Stern fan, if you haven't listened in a while, give it a shot. Because everyone thinks now that because he's on Sirius XM, it's going to be nonstop. Like, we're going to have hookers in. We're going to do crazy stuff. He actually does almost none of that. In fact, I can't remember the last time he had that kind of thing on, that he's lost all interest in that for some reason. So it's now he can just have people on and they can say anything they want. And so the Sheik definitely benefited from that, and it can be fascinating.
And he's
listening.
Gotten like not just like a second chance, but a third. Like the Sheik, the Iron Sheik, that guy has gotten multiple chances. It's incredible. Like I know Americans love a redemption story too, but like it's incredible how many ups, peaks, and valleys his career has had. You know, it's incredible that he's gotten so many other chances.
Yeah, well, and wrestlers, as we see in this documentary, typically you get to the peak and then you start heading down, and either you can kind of hold on by tooth and nail to kind of the mid level and show up occasionally in big events. And make a few bucks here and there and then go to conventions, or you just bottom out Jake the Snake style and you're a total mess of a human being.
It's kind of wild to see some of my heroes when I was in middle school now, like King Kong Bundy, Jake the Snake, Jimmy the Superfly Snuka, like how they look now, because I obviously haven't seen them in 30 years. Yeah. It's pretty incredible. So what, like watching this, what was something that you would wish they had either done a little bit more on or actually touched on that they didn't?
I wish we could have heard a little bit more about his family always comes from a very, they praise him a lot for being willing to go on the road, for working so hard, for doing all that stuff.
For getting sober.
Getting sober. You see a bit of the conflict when he's deep into his addiction stuff. It's because coming from a standpoint of someone who does performance, who has family, who all of us have been in that position where someone's given them the thought of, why don't you quit? Why are you still doing this? What are you getting out of it? I would be interested to find out more of at what point someone had to suggest, this clearly isn't working. Why are you still determined to be this persona, to be this wrestler? Yeah. Because you've bottomed out. You're at the lowest you can possibly go. You're doing these terrible high school gymnasiums in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. You're driving all over the place. Like, isn't there something better you could be doing?
He's holding on to that identity so hard. Like when he goes to just go sign autographs in like a Chuck E. Cheese or whatever.
That's a fascinating
spot. It's just like he's got the belt still. Like he's never he knows who he is, which is admirable, I think. But yeah, he's not going to just get a regular job. There's no way that guy's just going to get a regular job.
No, what would he do? No. Sell cars? Like, can you imagine?
Well, he seems like, as a coach, that seemed to be a thing that kind of carried through. Yeah. Where he's like, in the end, he's still like coaching people because he physically can't do much anymore. But he still, like, you know, has the experience. It's almost like, you know, Burgess Meredith and Rocky or something. Yeah. That could be his future.
And he clearly was a good coach. I mean, he won four championships when he was coaching before he became, you know, a famous wrestler. He was very good at what he did. So it's fascinating to think, because that's also something that I always wonder about when it comes, when someone is still sticking around and then comes back again when they're, you know, when they're 65 or 70 years old, how many times must you have heard, why don't you stop this? Why don't you give up? But he's always the Sheik, and there's no portrayal of that struggle.
So as a comedian, as someone that's doing this and you're in it, and did you feel some certain amount of thankfulness that you saw someone who's been living his dream and keeps doing it? I mean, how do you feel about that?
I mean, of course, because you always, especially as someone who's a struggling comedian at 35 years old, that's something that I've heard it, because I started when I was 27 and I had a quick bump of success where I was hosting at clubs, and then I moved out here and you got to start all over again. And after a few years, you start to see that look in your friend's eyes or your family's eyes of, are you still doing that? That's still something.
Yeah, still something you're doing.
And I think everyone goes through that. And that's one of the big humps, because I think we were talking about before we started recording.
We started talking about like this idea of like people that we know that are super driven.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that like killer instinct, and like, you kind of feel like you're lacking that, but like, we all still want to succeed in this business.
Yeah.
But there's almost like the fact that we're all San Francisco people, that is just like, we chose not to go to that other level.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that I took away from that documentary is the use of the word heat, which they say about 400 times, but how important when you have heat to strike when the iron's hot. Like, I get like that, really, I saw that and I was like, I kind of get it now. I actually, oddly enough, didn't really resonate that with me until I watched that documentary. Yeah. Like, when you have heat, go for it. That's when you've got to do it. So this is a question that we asked Matt, and I'm going to ask you too. In all the years that you've been watching documentary, could you recommend one for us?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. We'd talk. The King of Kong is my all-time favorite documentary.
That's a great one.
Yeah, and I think you guys will probably be doing that one in the very near future. I love King of Kong and Hoop Dreams.
Okay.
I just rewatched Hoop Dreams. It just came out on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And that one, my mother, when I was a kid, she would go to Costco.
Yeah.
And we didn't have cable. And the video store in our area, we were in a very small town, the selection was terrible. So she would go to Costco in the big town nearby, and she would just walk up, and whatever new tapes looked like they had a bunch of awards or Academy Awards or whatever, she would just buy those and bring those home. And I remember the stack was, it was The Shawshank Redemption, Hoop Dreams, and Pulp Fiction.
Jeez.
Where all mom brought those home.
And she was also, my parents were luckily very liberal about letting me watch. There was one weekend where she did rent for me. They were going to a party, and they were just leaving me at home. I was like 14 years old. She went to the video store and said, I need two good movies that a 14-year-old would watch. And the clerk at that store, God bless him, he gave her Goodfellas and Showgirls.
Whoa.
movies. And when my mom came back, like, how were they? I'm like, they were the most awesome movies I've ever seen in my entire life.
Okay, we definitely clipped on that.
Oh, yeah. But so she brought home Hoop Dreams, and I watched Pulp Fiction first because I'd heard so much about it. And then I watched Hoop Dreams, and that one, it's just astounding.
You want to see it rain? Make it rain.
Yeah. Hoop Dreams is amazing. And then, Santa, the one with Mick Foley in it.
Okay.
That one is another fascinating portrayal, because there's another one where Mick Foley, he's gained a certain amount of fame. He is, he loves being Santa, he loves Christmas, the whole thing, and so he embraces it. But there you also have these portrayals of these other men who are deep into being Santa, that they love Christmas, and so literally they're spending their entire year just building up to the chance to be Santa in their area, that they're like little mind for the month of December, they're in their glory, and then as soon as December 26th hits, it's back to to nothing.
I think there's a This American Life that's about the rivalry between real beard Santas and fake beard Santas.
Yeah, there Whoa. Is. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know if that's factored into that. That movie was made after that.
But they do they do touch on that because it is a thing where if you don't have a beard, then in stand up, if you're someone who if you haven't done a set at the Punchline yet, then it's like, oh well, you're new, like you're not even in my
or you're like a YouTube star who has never done an open mic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Drew Harmon, thank you for coming by. I appreciate it. Thanks for being on episode 2 of Sup Doc.
Thank you guys very much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
So that was our talk with Drew Harmon about The Sheik, and you can follow Drew on Twitter at Drew Harmon. Spelled it like you said it.
And please like and review this podcast on iTunes.
Yeah, and our theme music is by David Siegel.
And if you want to listen to more shows, go to supdocpodcast.com.